Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Candy's Closet, creating accessories that are influenced by different sources like music, nature, film, comics, social justice, and especially Latinx culture. Find Candy's Closet on Instagram or on Etsy. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. Renee Powers here, and you're listening to another excellent episode of Feminist Book Club, if I could be so humble. We've got so much planned for you in the coming weeks and months, so I tend to batch record interviews and then share them over the course of a few months, and I'm in the middle of scheduling those interviews right now, and let me tell you, there are some excellent conversations that we will be sharing with both writers and readers. But I would love to add, if you have a topic or a book you'd like us to discuss or a suggestion for a guest, our inbox is always open. Hello@feministbookclub.com. August book club orders went out this week and they're beginning to arrive at their new homes. There are few things I love more than seeing those boxes and shipments pop up on Instagram. Make sure you tag us, Feminist Book Club Box. But now that those babies have homes, it's time to start thinking about September. I know, it's wild. Time is flying, but also going nowhere. What is life right now? So I'm about to announce our September theme. Are you ready? Our September theme is Latinx voices. This month, we're celebrating Latinx Heritage Month, a commemoration from September 15th to October 15th that is linked to the independence anniversaries of several Latin American nations and is intended to uplift the cultural legacy of a group deeply rooted in rich traditions. Feminist Book Club has taken our cue from the Human Rights Campaign and has chosen to use the term Latinx rather than Hispanic or Latino in order to be more inclusive of the identities of non-binary and gender non-conforming people. The term Latinx also recognizes the indigenous Brazilian and other non-Spanish speaking people that celebrate during this month. At the same time, I am also aware of the colonialism associated with centering Latin origins, but we do feel that this term is most appropriate and inclusive for this month's theme. But as always, we welcome feedback and resources. That said, in addition to our book of the month, all the items we'll feature in our September boxes will be from Latinx-owned small businesses, and I am thrilled to share that first item. September box subscribers will receive a cuff bracelet from Candy's Closet, hand-stamped with the word feminist. These are so great. I stumbled upon owner Jeanette's Etsy shop a while back. I mean, probably 4 or 5 months ago, and I immediately wanted to purchase everything. Candy's Closet creates accessories that are influenced by a number of different sources, anything from music, nature, film, comics, social justice, and especially Latinx culture. Created by a broke college student with an obsession with skulls and flowers, it was made to be affordable to anyone trying to sweeten up any outfit. If you're looking for something for a friend or for yourself, anything from lollipop earrings to keychains with so much attitude that also embrace Spanglish, you'll want to check out this shop. We'll include a link to the store in the show notes, but it's Candy's Closet on Instagram and Etsy, and that's closet spelled with a K. So C in candy, K in closet. Our September pre-orders open tomorrow, so make sure you're on our email list. If you're excited about our Latinx Voices box, there's a link to that in the show notes as always, or just head to feministbookclub.com. Email subscribers will be the first to know when signups are live for our September box. And now, speaking of Latinx Voices, today's guest is Romina Garber, author of the gorgeous new book, Lobisona. And I don't mean just a gorgeous cover, but the book itself. The story is gorgeous. And low-key, I want Romina to be my new best friend. Her energy is just infectious. So stay tuned for this wonderful conversation about centering the point of view of girls, the Argentine folk story that inspired her book. We talk about making your place in a world that doesn't seem to want you, and even how the story can resonate with so many readers, but particularly immigrants and trans folks. So that's up next. Hi, everyone. Today, I am chatting with Romina Garber. Romina is a New York Times and international best-selling author whose books include Lobisona and the Zodiac series. Born in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and raised in Miami, Florida, she landed her first writing gig as a teen, a Sunday column for the Miami Herald that was later nationally syndicated, and she hasn't stopped writing since. Romina is a graduate of Harvard College and a Virgo to the core. Today, we are talking about her brand new book, Lobisona, and I am so excited to dig into this. Welcome, Romina.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
Okay, so the first question I ask is, what is your definition of feminism?
Feminism. That is a very good question. I think that everything boils down to choice and to equal opportunity and equal access and equal respect. So I feel like I can kind of set down my feminist sword when I see accurate representation that really reflects the real, like the real gender division. And when women are thinking as much as men are, when women are afforded the same respect over their bodies and their decisions as men are, when women are no longer told how to avoid sexual assault in certain situations, and instead men are told what's going to happen if they can't get it together and respect other people. So when the dialogue stops being about, oh, but though it's the woman's emotional responsibility, she needs to make sure the household is okay. She needs to really ultimately make sure she protects herself. Like when we start getting past that and suddenly there is no gender identity to whom certain tasks fall to or anything like that, then I think, you know, we will have achieved like what for me is the goal of feminism.
It seems simple. Why is it never that simple? Okay, so having said that, how does that definition then influence your writing? Because you've got a full series under your belt and Lobisona is the beginning of a new series. So how do you see that play out in your books?
I definitely approach my books from the perspective of a young girl discovering the world. And I think that's why, I mean, it's basically YA. But for me, I think that kind of girl perspective, for obvious reasons, like I just, you know, maybe as I grew up, there's something about that point in my life, like just really resonated, you know, and I kind of go back to it. So in my first series, Zodiac, which is about another universe of planetary systems or houses that are, each one is inspired by a different astrological sign. So the whole notion of it is that there is a great big bad sort of approaching the Zodiac and different houses are falling prey to different catastrophes and attacks. And no one has thought to connect all these things except for this one girl who sees this omen in the stars. And she's a 16-year-old from House Cancer, which is considered the house of nurture. And the symbol is a pregnant mother. And so that notion of like, it's even more important because warnings from Cancer aren't necessarily taken all that seriously. because they're considered more emotional and more, you know, and kind of less sort of suited for leadership. So it was important for me that it be that, but also that it be a young girl who's sounding the alarm and telling the truth. And part of it was this idea of leadership and politics and kind of how, like, there's this history of, and I'm going to say men, because historically more men have been in power. So if they would like to change that that depiction, then maybe they should make room for more women to step up to power. And then
amen.
So I'm going to say men. There's a history of, you know, us attaching hubris, you know, personal hubris to humanity's progress. And I think that's how certain politicians lose their way. They start to lie for the greater good, and because, you know, they don't want to distill the information down to everyone. And I think the important thing about Zodiac, the lesson was, this young girl refuses to lie. She's telling the truth. And so even when people on her side are saying, just lie, make it more palatable so that you get people on your side, she realizes that the first time she lies, it will be so much easier to lie a second time and a third and a fourth, and soon she'll lose her way. And, you know, again, what you said before, simple, such a simple measure, right? It sounds so easy to change the course of the world if we all just were honest, or our leaders were honest, but it does cause a revolution, you know, something that simple could, and it does. And so that was important. And more pertinently in Lovisona, it was important to have a young girl. I love the idea of the moon cycle and the menstrual cycle. I mean, that's obviously, it's a thing that predates like Lovisona by a lot. So, you know, it's a great concept, you know, and I love the idea of sort of blood playing this thing and this transformation, this shift, you know, like my periods have always been brutal, like, especially as a teen. Oh my goodness. Like, you know, I would be in so much pain. It would be hard to sometimes to get out of bed, you know? And I was like jealous of my friends who didn't have as much of a struggle with it. And so, and I feel like there's a stigma, you know, about it. And like, you know, you would hide your pads or your tampons or whatever, you know, and to this day, we still sort of do it, you know, and we're still not really allowed to talk about this stuff. And so I just thought it would be so powerful if there was something else happening with that shift. And of course, what is happening? We're becoming women. We're growing up. Like, when our menstrual cycle kicks in, so many other things are happening in our bodies. And what if that shift, you know, shifted our entire world? And it does. It shifts how people look at us, and it shifts how we look at the world. And I thought it was really important to have a girl to see this kind of like walk coming into powers thing, like that we see with Harry Potter and some of the, and, you know, Percy Jackson and some of these other series. But what if, like, you know, it's this girl and it's coming with the onset of her period, and every month sort of she starts noticing changes. Like, that's not so far off from what we go through.
Mm-hmm. And so even just an exaggerated version of puberty, of what she ends up experiencing. And we'll try to make this as spoiler-free as possible, but can you give us a fairly brief overview of Lovisona and the world and Manuela, the main character?
Absolutely. So Lovisona deals with Manuela, or Manu, who's living in hiding with her mom in Miami because they're undocumented immigrants. They came over from Argentina because they're on the run from her father's criminal family that we don't really know much about. Her father has passed, and so, you know, Manu doesn't know anything about him. But when her mom is picked up in an ICE raid and Manu is left alone, she decides this is kind of the time to follow all the clues and figure out who her father was. She doesn't really have many alternatives. So of course she does. And as she follows, she basically leads her into the Everglades. And in the Everglades, she comes across a magical sort of place and species. And so she discovers that her eyes, that there's other people with her eyes, and that she might actually belong somewhere. And so this whole mythology is based on actual Argentine sort of folklore and superstition. And the whole thing starts with a law that's actually present day in Argentina. That's La Ley de Padrinazgo Presidencial, which basically says that the president of Argentina becomes godparent to the seventh consecutive son or consecutive daughter in any family. What does godparent mean? It means that the state also covers all their educational expenses. So it's like a big thing. It's a big deal. And so I started looking into, why would you do this? This is such an arbitrary number. And I found out that there's like an old legend that says that the seventh consecutive son will be a lobizon, a werewolf, and the daughter will be a bruja. And there's tons of varieties and it's all over the world. But in Argentina, there's this law. And so supposedly it was implemented because there was a diplomat who came over, I want to say from Russia. And so like he asked the Argentine president if he would do this for his child because it was a tradition where he was from. And so then we just started doing it for everyone. But I think it's kind of fascinating that we don't really know if this law originated to something real or not, because there are also accounts that say that people in Argentina really believe this to be true and were abandoning their seven sons and all this stuff. And so that this was a countermeasure to that. So it's interesting because you don't know what's true and what's not. And that's kind of the area that's ripe for like writers to kind of like, you know, for the picking. And so, of course, the species I created, it's called the Septimus, which is the Latin word for seventh. And so the idea is the boys are wolves and the girls are brujas. And as you can tell by the title, this is like not a twist really, because the title, you know, she doesn't quite fit in to the right camp. So yeah. So, you know, and how much can we relate to that? How many times do we not fit into our camp? And one of the things that I added also, because, you know, all this stuff that's been happening with women's soccer and the US soccer team and how amazing they are, and yet how they don't, it's back to my definition of feminism, how they don't, they're not like respected the same way and rewarded the same way. And so there is a magical sport in Lobizona called Septibol. And so it's kind of magical soccer, werewolf soccer. And so, you know, and she's a natural at it. And I thought that was important too, you know, to see girls in sports, to be able to kick ass, you know, to kind of say, why should one thing be girl category stuff and one thing be boy category stuff, right? Like, that's so silly, you know, like we should be moving beyond that already.
I just have to say, I loved this book. I found it so immersive and so fun and so timely on all different sorts of issues. Obviously the immigration issues and she's undocumented and unafraid. I love that that's on the cover. But one of the things that really struck me is it could really easily be a story that's so relatable to trans kids or intersex kids who don't fit into the traditional, like you said, camps, the traditional genders. And
absolutely,
because Lobizona is a female werewolf and that's never happened before, right? It's so good.
Thank you. And she even has the questions of like wearing shorts versus a dress, you know, like does she, like it comes down to all these things that like, why should she have to stress about this? How silly is that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I imagine those are the exact kinds of questions that kids that are struggling with their gender identity are experiencing.
And why are we imposing those questions on them? That's my point. It's like, really, you know, and I do think that the newer generations are embracing that so much more, you know, and I do think it's where we're headed, I hope, you know, I thought that was really important to explore that.
So there are lots of issues that you tackle in here. Also want to talk about her undocumented status and what inspired you to write this into her background and her narrative.
Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, I'm an immigrant. I think I was very lucky that my dad had a working visa and 11 years later we became citizens. But for a lot of that time, I was terrified, you know, and it's wild because I'm feeling a lot of that terror again now as I hear about things like denaturalization committees or whatever, like that scares me. I don't want to lose my passport. And so I think those things kind of resonate a lot. And of course, like, you know, there's people in my life who've been undocumented and a lot of different things. So like, this is like representative of my whole family and a lot of loved ones. And the idea, I think that like the big push for that was when we started putting children into camps. When children started being caged, that kind of was a really big trigger. And a lot of the things I was thinking, you know, beyond the horror of it, beyond the unspeakable horror, was the fact that like my gosh, I was so lucky that I came over with my parents in the 90s when we did, you know, and that it, you know, because right now I would not want to be in that situation. And I felt like I had to use that privilege in some way, you know, or like kind of like parlay it to like give a voice to people who are right now being called illegal, which is like, to me, a crazy word to put on a human being. I mean, just think about the word for a minute. And then think about applying it to a person. And I mean, it's horrible. And, you know, in a big way, Lobisona is a treatise on labels. You know, it's about having access to two languages, but still lacking the language to define yourself. You know, like it's about coming from two worlds, but belonging to neither, you know, it's one of those things where like, as an immigrant, you experience and anyone who's ever heard a label, you know, or try to be trapped, someone try to cage them in a label, can understand. But primarily, this is like my dedication of this book is for all our children caught in the crosshairs of nationalism. And that is ultimately why I wrote this. Like, wherever you're from, whatever kind of border you're crossing, be it geographical or supernatural or, you know, just like an abstract barrier, like, this is for that. This is for coloring outside the lines. This is the case for that.
Yeah. And I love that ultimately, and again, no spoilers, but ultimately we see a new world created, that Manu doesn't fit into the magical world 100%. She doesn't fit into the United States 100%. She certainly doesn't fit in Argentina 100%. So she has to create something new. And I think that it's so inspirational for so many young readers. And I keep saying kids and young readers, but obviously YA, everybody reads YA, but it does have themes that will resonate with younger readers. I read that this book is actually about 10 years in the making.
So funny you would say that. Because just 2 seconds ago, literally 2 seconds ago, my mom found my first version of it. It was called Yellow Eyes. I don't know if you can see. I like hyperlinked all my chapters. I was such a good girl back then. And it says 2008.
Oh my goodness. So she's holding up, we're on video chat, she's holding up a stack of papers with a giant binder clip that she just found the first draft. That's incredible. Okay.
2008.
Why did it take so fucking long?
Oh, man. Because I will humbly submit to you that I am a far superior writer today than in 2008. So I will absolutely accept that, like, I probably wasn't ready yet. I don't know. But one of the things that I did experience was, and you know, I'm obviously not here to like knock anyone. I think this is just more representative of the system. But at the time when I went out with it to agents, I did hear that there was, let's just say, there was some hesitancy that the American teens would be interested in a bunch of Argentine immigrants and their stories. And so it was not as welcoming, the landscape. I don't know. I mean, you know, I hesitate to say it's more welcoming now because this is just my experience. You know, I can't speak for other people, but at the time it was particularly not. And so after that, I just started writing, you know, sort of people born in the States or other planets, whatever it is. But I definitely did not go back to trying to write my own culture. And part of my return to this book started in 2015, 2016, when I started going back to Argentina, not just as someone who goes back to see her family and everything, but for the first time I went back as an author, you know, who was speaking at the Feria del Libro de Buenos Aires and like having book events there and everything. And I connected with Argentina and Argentine teens in a way I never had before, because I took so much for granted, you know, like, I just, like, to me, it was just a part of me in my home, you know, and how your home, you're not as conscious of the details, you don't stop to take it in. And I did. And I was like, oh my goodness, like, how much of me have I been muting, you know, like, how many parts of me have been sleeping and started to bloom, sort of in this soil, in my homeland, in this kind of different setting. And so, yeah, I just knew, I think maybe not consciously, because I was still working on the Zodiac series at the time, But something in me was like, you should not have walked away from that book. Like, that was a big mistake. You should have fought harder. And then, of course, all this other stuff with Kids in Cages started happening. And again, that voice was like booming, you know, like, what are you doing? And then, and so a funny side note is I'd met Tomi Adeyemi throughout all of this. She and I both went to Harvard, and but she's much younger than me, like almost a decade probably. So,
really?
So we never like met as students.
Yeah.
But we met at an alumni event that a friend of mine organized. And at the time, Tomi was working on her first YA, and she was, you know, starting the whole submission process. And, you know, she knew I had the Zodiac series. And so we were like, oh, let's talk. And so thus started this like friendship, you know, it was like a mentorship, but really a friendship. But then, you know, I would like, we'd meet up for pizza and to talk. And then I'd introduce her to authors at book events, you know, and different things and whatever. And she would come to my launches. And then of course came the day that she calls me and she's like, are you sitting down? You know, like the whole thing. Or maybe I said, are you sitting down? Because I can't breathe, you know? So it was like an amazing, and so what I like, basically, this is the beautiful thing of putting yourself out there and letting yourself affect and be affected by other people, because it always comes back. And so when I was trying to figure out like what to do with these pages I had, with this idea, with this failure, with this kind of new blank slate, you know, that Zodiac was on and all this stuff was happening, Tomi gave me back like what I gave her, you know, like she was like, all right, you can do this. Like, this is how we fight. These are our weapons. This is what we do. And so it became this thing of like, I found my fight, you know?
What a beautiful, like, literary sisterhood that
oh my God, yes.
And her, because, you know, her books are the Children of Blood and Bone series and so set in a very specific culture too, that I could imagine that just is going to open even more doors for so many other people writing these kinds of fantasies.
Totally, totally. So, I mean, I feel like how beautiful is that when like we lift each other up, and you know, that's sort of feminism, you know? And yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of wild to come back to this book, you know, and again, it's a totally different book now. I don't want to be saying like, I didn't rewrite the same book, you know, but
right.
The point is, it's based on the same seed of an idea, which is this Argentine law and this species, you know, and this idea of a girl who is an other, you know, who just is not quite anything, but somehow also one of them, you know.
So being on the other side of the Zodiac series and beginning the Wolves of No World series, and the Zodiac series obviously was your first, and there's like a whole set of expectations and not really knowing how it's going to go. But do you feel like this is markedly different setting out on a very Argentinian novel series?
Yes, I do. It does feel different. It also feels different to have my own name on it.
Oh, tell me more.
Instead of a pen name, you know? And part of the debate on that for me was I didn't want this book coming out not under my name, because it felt a little bit like disingenuous for me to be laying bare my soul, but under a name that, you know, doesn't even have like my whole history. You know, it's like I'm a history of like, basically I'm descended from many immigrants, you know? And so my name like carries a lot, you know? And so, yeah. So it's to me having a book out there that's got my own name, you know, and like really tackles my culture and something is personal and politically, like you said, timely and pertinent right now. It's such a different experience also because like, it's so Spanglish, you know? And so it's like, I felt like I was a little freer in my writing because I think in Spanglish. And so it was so nice to be able to like write like that, you know? But you, with the Zodiac series, because it's in 9 languages, there was something very international about it. And I got to go to a lot of countries to promote it and talk about it and hear from a lot of readers. And I really... there was something about that one that transcended also, you know, I think maybe it's just a theme I'm constantly like chasing because of this idea of like, I don't know where I fit in, you know, I don't know like what my identity is, you know, I can't imagine living in Argentina again after being gone for most of my life, you know, but at the same time, something we joked about a little before we started this is that I can't run for president because I am an immigrant, you know? And so like there, and it's not because I want to run for president, but it's this idea of my potential in this country is finite, you know, and there is a limit and there, and there's something about that that makes it hard. Like it just makes you feel like, why would I not make a good president? You know what I mean? Or why shouldn't I have the equal chance? So you know, I think that restlessness and whatever is probably always going to be reflected in my books.
Yeah. Okay, so before we go, I would be remiss to not ask about the character Hasmin, because this is what I witnessed as I read it. So Hasmin is like the head of the school that Manu becomes a part of, and she's very stringent in the rules. And it comes out that Manu is a lobisona and also a girl, and that's weird and that's never happened before. And Hasmin is very stringent on, she has to be a bruja. And it strikes me as women are often the ones upholding patriarchal norms. Was that your intention when you went into writing Hasmin?
Yes, exactly. We've kind of absorbed a lot of things. And I think that like, there's things that we're going to have to work on in ourselves to eradicate, because it's how can the system not sort of seep into your skin and sort of your insides, you know? And I do think that we need to start to dismantle a lot of the ideas that we've kind of like internalized without really stopping to analyze. And in Hasmin, you definitely see that. You know, it's funny, like I had some experiences growing up that kind of crafted her character in a weird sense. And I only am seeing this in your bringing this up, because, you know, one of my very first jobs, I was still a teen, like it was like an internship, and it was like a very important one. And I just remember there was only one woman on the exec board. It was like a big exec board, only one woman. And I looked up to her so much because I was like, that's who I'm going to be. And then one day she calls me into her office. And I just remember thinking like, she finally noticed me, like out of the intern pool. Like she's like, she's going to be me one day. And I was like, and I'm going to be like, this is amazing that you read my mind. And instead she was like, some of the employees are complaining that too many of the men are always gathered around your desk and always coming to talk to you. So yeah, she was telling it to me, like I had to, and I'm like, I was a teenager. This is like my first internship. And the point is, go back to your whole thing. You said gathered at my desk. You didn't say I went to other people's desks. And these are grown men. So the fact that you just don't have the guts to go to them, or that you just don't think they're in the wrong.
Right.
So this is what I'm saying. Again, I don't think there's anything bad about her innately, or like, you know, I don't think she doesn't think women are equal to men, but I do think there's things you don't stop to analyze. And a lot of that is because of what our culture says, of what the sort of narrative goes. And like I was saying to you before about my definition of feminism, when we stop putting it on the, and I don't want to say victim, but just on like the person who's on the receiving end of the like bad behavior, like that's what we need to do. We need to start like correcting men. And I feel like one of the issues, like that, what not issues, but one of the venues that is left to really that we need to sort of hone in on are like, well, no, but you know what? We're getting away from the book. Let's go back to the book. I'm doing what I did. I just caught myself doing what I did before we started. I start to ramble on my philosophies. So back to Hasmin. So to me, Hasmin really represents that woman who sort of internalized a lot of this, and also has that kind of, here's the other issue we see a lot. When we look at executive boards of companies, or, you know, kind of like who's up there, a lot of times there's only one woman, like I was saying before, or one person of color or whatever. So we're primed to think that we're competing for that one spot. That is what the patriarchy wants us to do, because that keeps us busy tearing each other down. Instead, we should be like, I'm sorry, like there's room at this table for more seats. We can squeeze it, you know, and bring everyone to the table, or start setting your sights on some of those positions that aren't currently inhabited by a woman, you know. But it's that kind of thing where we need to be the ones helping each other. And I do think that there are, and Jasmine is not the only, you know, girl in, or woman in this book, or bruja, sorry, that suffers from that, you know? And I think it's a very patriarchal way of thinking, this kind of way of thinking that benefits the patriarchy, that, you know, ultimately we need to approach all of this, our ambition and leadership and getting to these places, in a way that's more organic to us. And as women, I don't think I don't always think that the methods that men use are right for us. And, you know, in a lot of times, I'm less happy if I'm getting something at the price of someone else, not like that bothers me. So I do think that women are better suited for a lot of these positions because we do want to bring everyone else up with us. We want everyone to be, you know, and when we try to adopt some of these other, you know, perspectives that maybe aren't as reflective of us, I think we see these women, these caricature kind of women that we talk about, who are kind of like holding our feminists back, you know? Yeah.
So good. So good. I loved that character because she represents so much of, like you said, women in power upholding patriarchy. It's just, the characters in this are so robust, and they represent so many different backgrounds and facets of femininity and masculinity, and there are queer characters and there are people of color, and it's just great. Okay, so my final questions as we wrap up are, do you have a book that's not your own that you would like to recommend to our audience?
Okay, I do. So bear with me. Let's start. I'm obviously showing you covers because I can't help myself. So Nicole Maggi, What They Don't Know. This is my critique partner. And when she wrote this book, it kind of destroyed me. And I'm sad that it didn't get the kind of attention that it deserved, because it's about choice and it's about abortion rights. And it's about two girls who have very different views on it. And it's all told through their alternating journal entries. And it's so cool, so powerful, so feminist. And, you know, I feel like it deserves like a look. And I think there's a lot of girls out there who are actually really in need of it. And then another one that I wanted to mention is Girl Squads by Sam Mag. And it's
I know this
awesome.
One. It's great.
It's great. Yeah. And it goes through like all these different female friendships that changed history. Like, come on, that's on my nightstand always, you know, like, because I just like it uplifts me. And then a book that is the next on my TBR that I already know I'm going to love is Diamond City, Francesca Flores, and it's a Wednesday book. And I have to do a pitch to Isabel, because she totally threw it back to her. Woven in Moonlight, amazing.
So I read Diamond City a couple months ago. I got an arc of it, and you're going to love it. It's so good. It's so gritty, and like, it's just so good.
So excited.
And Woven in Moonlight, I will link Isabel's
interview
yes. in the show notes. If you haven't read that one, it's Bolivian fantasy. If you like that, you'll love Lobisona. Vice versa, if you love Lobisona, you'll love Woven in Moonlight too. Thank you so much for those suggestions. All of that will be linked in the show notes. And my final question, where can we connect with you online if we want to reach out and say hey?
Well, I am always up for reaching out and saying hey. On Instagram, I'm at Romina Garber. And on Twitter, I'm at Romina Russell.
Perfect. I will link those as well. Thank you so much, Romina. You are such a delight to talk to. And I loved this book. And I loved talking to you about this book.
Thank you so much. You've totally made my day. I'm actually on the last pages of the sequel right now, like in the first draft. And it's so funny that you mentioned Jasmine, because she's like very like much on my brain right now. And I'm like, what do you want to tell me about her? Like, don't talk to me about that witch. Like, so
I'm so
excited to share with you. You were a delight to talk to me. Like, this was so wonderful. Thank you.
This was fun. All right, take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time. A well-read woman is a thing.